Merry Christmas. This is the voice of Northwest Indiana, 89.1 FM, WLPR Lowell. Well, Steve Walsh and Ryan Priest remain in the studio with me as we get set to take on a subject that we're all kind of big on, and that's Gene Shepard.
Exactly. Gene Shepard is best known for A Christmas Story, the 1983 movie about growing up at the foot of the steel mills in Hammond, Indiana, where little Ralphie lusts after a Red Ryder BB gun. But Shepard is also a well-known author and long-running radio personality. To fill us in, we have Gene Bergman, author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, and the recently completed follow-up, Keep Your Knees Loose. Gene, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
So, now, except for some wonderful programs that we put together here on Lakeshore FM, many people in Northwest Indiana don't know that their own Gene Shepard, who's actually the narrator in the movie The Christmas Story, was actually a long-running radio personality, mainly in New York. Tell us a little bit about his career.
Well, he started actually in a small station in Hammond, Indiana, and then for a couple of years he was a disc jockey, a broadcaster, and personality in Cincinnati and Philadelphia. And then in 1955, he moved to New York. And one of the major things he did in the mind of great Gene Shepard fans is he did an overnight broadcast for about 6 months in early 1956. That is, he was on from 1 till 5:30 in the morning. And all of his programs were done improvised. He had no script at all. He might have had a little note to himself on what he was going to talk about. After the overnight shows, then he was on for several hours on Sunday night, and then for 21 years he was on New York radio, WOR, talking 45 minutes a night, five nights a week, sometimes six nights a week, just about everything you can think of. He told stories, of course. He made commentaries on the passing scene. He humorously commented on what he called human foibles, that is, the strange little odd things that people do that are not quite what he would call normal, but are kind of funny and endearing. And he would play his odd instruments, a kazoo, nose flute, Jew's harp, and he would even knock out tunes by rapping his knuckles on his head. But he was quite a varied character.
Dan Vindert here. You know, one of the things that amazes me listening to those old broadcasts, specifically those hour-length thing or sort of 45-minute type of things you were talking about that he did in the evenings in New York, is that he would start out with a story and go off on a bunch of tangents, sometimes multiple times, and keep finding a way to winding those back into the story, and it would all make sense in the end. I mean, how did he develop that ability to tell a story like that?
Well, I'm not sure how he developed the ability, but I can tell you that he was an inveterate talker, and not only on his radio program, but all the time, 24 hours a day. He was a ham radio operator, so he talked on his radio. And if he met somebody in the offices of WOR, he would corner them and give them a 45-minute monologue, just about whatever crossed his mind. So this is something he'd been doing for quite a few decades, and I guess he just got used to all the ins and outs of doing it over the years, and he was a master at it.
And Gene, it seems like, to me, Gene Shepard seems like the sort of Martha Stewart of childhood memories. He knows how to package and repackage these. These show up in articles in Playboy. These same stories are retold and reshaped, and they become part of his radio broadcast. Then they become books, and then some of them become movies, like A Christmas Story. Do you think that was intentional? And do these stories change over time as he retells them and retells them?
Well, actually, the first time he tells them or gives them out to the world in general were actually on his radio program, which he improvised. And then they were written down and published in Playboy, then gathered together into his best-selling books, including In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. And then in 1983, the movie was written. He made slight changes. Each time that he told a story on the radio, let's say, it would change in some of the small details, even though the main thing would remain as it had originally been. So there were slight changes, and in fact, one of the differences between his stories on the radio and A Christmas Story, for example, is A Christmas Story, of course, had a written script, and he tended to be a little bit more, shall we say, focused, a little bit more dramatic and emphatic in his narration for the movie than he would be telling a story on his 45-minute radio program.
Gene, this is Ryan Priest. As one of the, is a lover of radio history, Gene Shepard perpetuated one of the great radio stunts ever, and this was through a book that he had people request that hadn't even been published, and I, Libertine. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how that all came to be?
Yes, this was during his overnight shows in 1956. The story, as he tells it, is he went into a major New York bookstore and asked for a book that he knew existed. I guess he'd seen it or heard about it. And the clerk couldn't find it in his list. It wasn't in books in print. There was no place where the clerk could find this title. So he said to Shepard, book doesn't exist. You must have the title wrong or something. Doesn't exist. And Shepard was very upset. So he thought that he would pull a prank. And on his late night show, he suggested that people are too much involved with their list and what lists mean and the importance of lists. And here is a book that wasn't on a list, but he knew it existed. So let's make up a book. Let's get a title. And his listeners called in possible titles, and he settled on I, Libertine, a novel of 18th century England. So then he came up with the name of the author, who was also totally non-existent, Frederick R. Ewing, and he asked his listeners to go out and ask for this book in bookstores to confuse people who expected to find it on lists. You know, if one person goes in and asks for a book and they can't find it, you got it mixed up with something else, doesn't exist. But if a lot of people start doing it, the book dealers must think that, this really must exist. I got to find out about it. So they went back to their distributors, and the distributors were getting requests for it, and they couldn't find it. So
so it keeps going, and it keeps weaving
going
through, like all Gene Shepard stories tend to do.
And he ended up having to write the book.
Yes, details are a little uncertain. You get different variations, but ultimately, the publisher Ian Ballantyne of Ballantyne Books got together with Gene, who had the basic idea for the story, and science fiction author Theodore Sturgeon. And it said that Sturgeon very quickly wrote almost all of the book in a really fast session in a couple of days, but he fell asleep before the last chapter was written. So Ballantyne's wife, who was also an editor, wrote the last chapter. And within a few months after the hoax was begun in early 56, by the fall, the book was out there in paperback and hardcover and became a bestseller. It was reviewed all over the place, and it was quite a thing.
So in the end, the story became the truth.
Yes.
And that's what I want to ask you. You know, I grew up in Hammond and Munster. My dad worked in the steel mills, and Shepard's stories really ring true. But how true are they? Is he really Ralphie? Was his best friend really Flick? And did this stuff really happen?
The general belief is that these are autobiographical stories or memoirs. He insisted that this was all totally made up. Now, sometimes he would say, yeah, this happened, or I was friends with these people, and other times he would say, nah, none of that's true, it was all made up. Well, we do know that some of the people that he mentioned, such as Flick and some of the other male friends and girlfriends, were real people. However, it's virtually certain that the details were totally made up. They were just created out of his mind, and he said that none of this stuff really happened. He made it up. He was an artist. He was a creator. For example, the Flick family, Flickinger family, were constantly being asked if poor Flick really did get his tongue stuck on a cold pole, and the Flick family was constantly having to say, no, our little boy Flick never got his tongue stuck to a pole. That was totally made up.
And I remember hearing or seeing an interview with him saying that, gee, I knew who the guy was, Gene Shepherd, but, you know, we weren't really best buddies or anything. So some details were true, and some details fudged a little bit.
Yeah, he fudged more than a little bit.
All right, so, you know, like Michael Jackson, Northwest Indiana did not see a lot of Gene Shepherd after he became successful. In fact, the movie was filmed in Toronto and Cleveland, not back here in Hammond. Did Gene love Hammond? Did he love this area? Because sometimes you really can't tell from the stories.
Actually, he you've got it right. Sometimes he loved it. Sometimes he felt a little bit less than love about it. However, Hammond, in some ways, really admired and gave tributes to him. They named their community center, a brand new, really great building in Hammond that opened in 2005, is the Gene Shepherd Community Center. They gave him a award as one of the great citizens of Hammond. And he came and was very appreciative of hearing it. Let's see, Hammond Achievement Award in 1981. And there's a picture of him on the poster. And he was delighted to be honored in that fashion. So he was a little bit conflicted over his feelings about Hammond.
It certainly did. It made him a fair amount of money. I don't think he would have had a career if he hadn't grown up in the cold Midwestern steel town.
Well, that's one of the things that he said, that he was always grateful that he had indeed grown up in Hammond, in that area of the country, and that it was an inspiration for much of his work, especially including, of course, his short stories that had so many permutations in different media. So he was grateful for that. And, in fact, A Christmas Story is what really gave him the money to be quite comfortable. And, in fact, one of the things he says in one of his TV programs is, filthy rich at last. And it's understood that it was because of the money he was making from A Christmas Story.
So did any of these places really exist? People keep guessing at what the locations were. Was it Goblatz where he goes to see Santa? Or maybe it could be Minus's, which was a little local department store in downtown Hammond. There was a story in the Times just recently that Cam Lands was the chop suey place. Do we know where all this stuff took place?
Well, we know where most of them took place. I believe there was only one Chinese restaurant in the town at that time, so that must have been the one. And I believe that Goldblatt's is the store that's considered to be the one that he was referring to. It's interesting that a couple of years ago, Hammond did a really special tribute to him at the time, at Christmas time, regarding A Christmas Story. They actually published a little brochure. I wrote a very small portion of it, but one of the major things in this brochure was a map of different places in Hammond that are referred to in Gene Shepherd's stories, and there are little photographs of the people in the Chinese restaurant, of his teacher Miss Shields, and the place where she lived, and Flick's house, and of course his own house on Cleveland Street. So they really did it up big with accurate depictions of.
He was
and you could
Cleveland
walk
Street.
From place to place or drive and see all these places.
And he did go to Warren G., like my wife, he did go to Warren G. Harding Elementary School, probably the only public building in North America actually named after that disgraced president.
Right.
Why did he change the name of the town from Hammond to Homan?
Well, I think that was part of his desire to create a fictional world, as he said, sort of like Faulkner did in the Yucknapatawpha County in the South. He wanted it to be not just a specific place, but an amalgam of places in Northwest Indiana. And of course, Hammond has a road that is named Homan. So he was, even though he changed the name of the town, he was still linking it up there a bit.
Yeah. Before we let you go, one thing, maybe Ryan, you might want to address this. We have a Gene Shepherd special that we're going to be airing later this morning here on the radio station at 11 a.m., again at 6 p.m., and then we're going to repeat it on Christmas Day at noon. And Ryan Priest, you're the host of it. This is a Christmas broadcast from 1967.
Yes, Christmas Day 1967, which I believe is the first time that he read Duel in the Snow. On WOR, and really interesting. It was read without commercial interruption, which was, you know, without commercial interruption was kind of was different for a Gene Shepherd program. But looking forward to having that on the air this afternoon.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Gene.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Yeah. I always enjoy talking about Shepherd.
All right. So this has been Gene Bergman, the author of Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, and the recently completed follow-up, Keep Your Knees Loose. Thanks for being on, Gene.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Merry Christmas. This is the voice of Northwest Indiana, 89.1 FM, WLPR Lowell.